Broadcast out of New York City, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on the Progressive Radio Network on Monday, December 10th. I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. Thank you for joining us on our weekly Prescriptions for Health show on the Progressive Radio Network every Monday from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and from 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. And remember that our shows are available 24/7 on PRN.FM and on drsaputo.com.
Today you will hear Vicki's 2020 health tips at 20 after the hour and 22 the hour. And we've got another great show for you today that's going to include why amalgams, root canals, and cavitations are dangerous, something we've wondered about for a long time. How safe is dentistry?
And why is iron important in infections, cancer, aging, and brain development?
Is it DNA or lifestyle that regulates our genes, or maybe some kind of combination?
And can rice bran prevent cancer?
Are essential oils a good way to lower blood pressure?
And much, much more. So can your teeth be making you sick? You know, we all know that bacteria in our mouths cause cavities, but have you thought about root canals? What about having your wisdom teeth out? Did you know that these are both breeding grounds for multiple bacteria? And I'll bet you didn't know that amalgam fillings containing copper and mercury can also be breeding grounds for bacteria.
There's a lot going on in dental work that we don't really pay attention to, and the American Dental Association has been anything except receptive to the work that Weston Price did back in 1909 and that the Mayo Clinic did. And much work has been done since that time. So we've got a lot that we've learned from people like Dr. Hal Huggins, who's a dentist who has brought a lot of this field forward starting in about the middle 1980s.
This shows where knowledge is power. This is why it's good for people to be taking responsibility for their health and being able to have intelligent questions to ask their dentist. Well, and where they might even know, end up knowing more than their dentist when they get through listening to us.
Well, it's true. See, there's a lot of information that we have that is in the mainstream research, but it's not looked at. And part of the reason for that is because dentistry is business, too. It's not primarily service. The dentist would like to make it primarily service, but the people who are providing them with the technologies that they're using are interested in keeping things the way they are, because it's about not changing away from the from what they are doing that makes them income.
So and it influences our health.
Big time. And I would say most doctors are unaware that amalgams, root canals, and cavitations are a problem. And most dentists are in denial.
Well, sometimes you hear about people being prescribed an antibiotic when they're going to be having dental work done if they have a heart problem.
Sure.
But, you know, inflammation is the main cause of disease, like with cardiovascular disease. Tell the story about the heart attacks in the rabbits.
This is really fascinating work. This is what was done by Weston Price and back in 1909, along with the Mayo Clinic. And what they did is they implanted root canal fragments from someone who had suffered a heart attack, and then they would implant that into a rabbit. And within a few weeks, 100% of the rabbits developed heart attacks. That's telling you there's something in there that's doing something to cause the same problem that the person who had a problem with their tooth had and had a heart attack.
That's really scary, isn't it? I mean, the bacteria and the toxins that the bacteria produce are causing disease.
Well, they also tested, the Mayo's tested about 11,000 rabbits, and Weston Price tested about 60,000 rabbits. There's a lot of data here done.
And how did they ignore that?
Well, they didn't ignore it, but, I mean, everybody else ignored it.
I mean, the American Dental Association.
They wanted to keep doing what they were doing. They thought root canals were the cat's meow because it would solve the problem of pain, and they didn't think there was any issue of there being any bacteria. Well, they even found where they injected the supernatant without the bacteria. They filtered the bacteria out. They had the same problem. The rabbits developed a problem with heart attacks.
Sounds like a homeopathic remedy for disease.
Well, actually, it's not homeopathic. It's a direct toxin that's a biochemical effect on the rabbit. So we've got, but there is some homeopathy we'll get to in a minute.
But, you know, also they were saying that you can get strep pneumonia from root canals.
You get all kinds of things. They found that the way bacteria will work, how they develop their toxins, and they have the ability to make four or five toxin, different toxins. It's not just one like we assume most of the time. It depends on the host and how well the host is or what kind of a problem they have that determines what kind of a toxin that bacteria will produce and what kind of illness that will produce in the person.
Well, I know that I was reading in this article about root canals can produce 92 types of microbes. And along with that, if each one is producing five toxins, that's 460 toxins. So one root canal can have 92 types of microbes along with 460 toxins from them, well, just in one tooth.
So that can show you there's a lot of variation here in what can go wrong. So this business of dentists thinking that they can seal off a root canal is really not true. Because what happens is there's the second layer of the tooth is called the dentum. And that has miles, literally miles of tubules in it. And when they put in the material they put to seal it off, it doesn't seal off all of the, of those tubules. So the debris and the microbes that are living in there continue to live and continue to grow. And when they do, they produce problems like what we're talking about.
Well, the same thing with all the accessory canals. I think there's something like 75 of those, so they can't sterilize all that.
No. See, there are four root canals in a molar. There are two in most other teeth and sometimes just one. But they've got all these accessory canals as well that's loaded with, again, miles of tubules. It's amazing at the microscopic level how thin these things are, but yet can accommodate the growth of bacteria.
I remember one time years ago, I had had a root canal, and I went to the dentist, and he went inside of there, and he took out this little thing that was brown and looked
Yucky at the tip.
Really disgusting.
Yeah.
And he took it out of the root canal, and he said now he was going to clean it out in there.
Right.
And put something that was clean back in there. But when you think about all these miles of tubules
you can't
canals
plug it all
and everything,
up.
That's disgusting to think that I have all that in there.
Every root canal is infected. That's what these people are saying.
Well, plus you end up with necrotic tissue in the root canal.
Well, that oozes out every time that you chew. So what you've got is something that continues to produce more bacteria. They continue to grow. They have to go someplace. So they ooze out every time, particularly you chew. And that causes a lot of bacteria to be in the area around the tip of the tooth. And that's why when they pull that root canal, that tooth out, there's a little bit of pus at the tip of the tooth.
So it's
a regular thing.
So it squirts out into your bloodstream?
It squirts out into the tissues around there, into the bone, into the gum, and into the bloodstream. That's right. You may see 400 times as much bacteria in the area around the tooth as the bacteria begin to grow than you'll see in the tooth itself.
So you're getting it in your bones.
You get it in your jawbone. And you're getting it in other areas of the body. So
it's better to have the tooth pulled than to get a root canal.
Well, from that point of view, that's true. Root canals are probably overdone a bit. And why are they done most of the time? Either because there's a clear infection that the dentist can see on an x-ray, which isn't, by the way, foolproof. And that's something we really have to worry about, or because there's pain in the tooth. A lot of the time, the nerve is irritated by something that's happening there. The only solution to eliminate the pain is to do a root canal. But it's not the sacred cow that so many dentists think is the right thing that we should be doing.
Yeah, because many times people have this tooth pain because of what the amalgam is made out of, especially with the ones that have the copper mixed with the mercury. And according to this article, the best way is to treat it with a composite filling, not with a root canal. And the other thing that happens is that there's a high negative electrical charge, and it fries the pulp chambers from the copper.
Yeah, and that causes pain. One of the things I was going to get to is say we've developed technologies, you know, since the time of the discovery of this, and the dentists haven't kept up with it, but I have to admit, neither has the medical profession. I've found the use of infrared light is amazingly calming.
For tooth pain.
Absolutely potent.
But if we're talking about getting at the cause, though, you don't want to have one of these fillings that has copper and mercury in it.
That's true, but the point I was making was a different one, and that's that a lot of root canals get done that are needless They don't need to be done because of trying to treat pain. When you can calm the nerve down, I mean, you always want to look for the cause of what's going on, but a lot of the times when a tooth has been filled with a cavity that's because of a big cavity, it's close to the root canal and where the nerve is, and that can sensitize it. So heat and cold can make that a real problem. But if you use the photon stimulator, it reduces the sensitivity of the nerve, and it goes away permanently.
Well,
I'd say in about three-quarters of the people that I've treated, I've seen that. Now, we need clearly to do more investigation on that. We need the clinical trials, and we need to be sure that what I've observed on a few patients is something that you would see in the masses. But, I mean, there's a lot of potential here. I think every dentist should have a photon stimulator, and they particularly the endodontists, the ones that are doing the root canals. So there's a whole field here that needs to be explored when it comes to pain management.
Well, this certainly makes the cause of disease more complex when you add lifestyle and your immunity and antibiotics and genes to the mix. And now we're thinking about adding your teeth and if you have a root canal or if you have a cavitation.
Well,
that's another part of a healthy lifestyle is what you have done in your mouth.
Well, that's true. I mean, your body is all connected. It's all one thing. And if you've got an area that's not functioning right or that has infection and inflammation, it's going to affect the rest of it as well.
So another source of infection is cavitation. So let's define what cavitation is.
Okay. When you take a wisdom tooth out, or you take any tooth out for that matter, what's left is a hole that goes down into the bone. And what the Weston Price people are saying is that those wisdom tooth sockets particularly rarely heal, and they become cavitations virtually 100% of the time. So what they're saying is that that hole that stays there that doesn't heal harbors a lot of bacteria. And they found that there are up to 92 different kinds of species of bacteria. And they've checked this in thousands of people and found that that's a universal rule. And so if you've got all this infection in there, you can expect there's going to be inflammation, and you're going to have the problems with what you see with some people who don't have good health having chronic diseases that are flared by it.
So who do you go to that knows how to take care of this cavitation?
Well, that's
get
a problem.
Tooth pulled?
Usually an environmental dentist is what we're talking about.
Well, what about just like a surgeon, like an oral surgeon?
Oral surgeons in general don't believe it. I know when when I had my wisdom teeth removed because they thought there was an infection there, and by the way, there wasn't. It looked like it on the x-ray, and my tooth was fine. I should have been smart enough at the time to say, well, let's just wait and see what happens, but I didn't. I went along with what they said because I didn't know this at the time. This was 20 years ago, and so they took out a good tooth. And what you wind up with is a cavitation at the bottom that doesn't heal well and harbors this infection that could be a real issue for people who have a weakened immune system.
Well, one of the things that they were suggesting is that after the tooth is pulled, instead of trying to stop the bleeding right away by packing it,
mm-hmm.
to allow it to bleed for 5 minutes.
That's
because
right.
That gets washes out the toxins.
Right. And those teeth that are infected, and there's an abscess at the bottom, there's a lot of bacteria that harbor in the tissues around the tooth and the bone as well. And that's why when they take an x-ray, they see that there's involvement in the bone. And that's what leads to a lot of those teeth coming out. So if they will do that and let it bleed for a longer time, for about 5 minutes, a lot of those bacteria will wash out. Then you can go ahead and do the normal healing things that we do.
I remember one time this patient had a cavitation,
mm-hmm.
and he needed to go to the dentist to have it taken out.
Mm-hmm.
It was
it's a mess.
Kind of gross.
Yeah.
I was invited to go and be there while he had this done with this particular naturopath at the time.
So
it was
as a
long
nurse,
time
you went.
Ago. So I went as a nurse and I gave him an IV of vitamin C and
right.
I think it was
glutathione. Probably.
Glutathione mm-hmm. At the same time that was supposed to make it better, but it wasn't the kind of surgery I'd want to have,
no.
I'll tell you that. It just looked like a bloody mess.
Well, I think we need to become aware of the problems that we have with our teeth. You know, we know that people who have periodontal problems have a higher risk for developing heart attacks and probably strokes, too. And all these kinds of things that can develop depend on the strength of the host as well as the amount of bacteria that's there. Not everybody who has a root canal needs to have their tooth extracted. as you get older, or if you have a problem with a chronic disease, or you have a lot of inflammation in your body, your risk for becoming ill becomes a bigger problem.
And maybe all they need is to get that amalgam out of there and put in a composite. Now, a composite, you can have that determined by some types of blood work and so forth.
There are tests you can do for that.
Tests that you can do. There's something also called a Clifford test.
Yeah, that's for compatibility matching. That's
yeah, right. So that you can have the materials that are in the composite that are in your that fill your tooth that are compatible with your body.
Exactly.
Because these amalgams can affect your nervous system.
Well, that's the mercury that comes out primarily, but it's also copper.
And the copper, both of them. And according to this study by Price, it was like just a teeny, tiny, tiny, tiny little amount, like a quadrillionth of an amount of copper that was toxic.
Right.
Yeah. So copper's not good in our teeth.
Well, copper's not good in your amalgams, neither is mercury. You know, the only place the Environmental Protection Agency will allow mercury to be put is either in a toxic waste dump
or
your mouth. And I'm going, oh, there, that makes a lot of sense.
Or in a shot.
Well,
or
that's
vaccination.
Right, for a vaccination, for an immunization, that's correct. So this whole business of sterilizing root canals is something we can't really do. We would like to think we can, but we can't.
Well, some people can tolerate them okay, and other people it can kill them.
Well, that's why we're talking about what's the strength of the person. And that's why in some people, like, for example, I have two root canals I've had since I was about 14 or 15 years old because I ran into a drinking fountain when we were playing tackle football and knocked a couple of teeth in half. And so the dentist went ahead and did root canals and put a post and all that stuff in. And I'm sure there's infection at the tip of those root canals. There'd have to be because it was, you know, more than half a century ago. And yet at the same time, because I'm healthy, I don't worry about that. But in somebody who has an advanced disease, you know, they have cancer or they have AIDS or they have some other kind of problem that is neuromuscular, like all kinds of things, then it becomes an issue. Then you start worrying about the mercury, not that you shouldn't be worried about it anyway, and you start worrying about the other things like root canals and cavitations because they're taking away from your wellness buffer. And what I mean by that is there's a range where there's perfect health and your biochemistry is exactly what it should be, and there's nothing wrong with you. And then as you begin to lose that wellness, you move towards having symptoms as you become less healthy. And you get to a certain place, and all of a sudden, it's like jumping off a cliff. Things all fall apart because you've lost that whole buffer between where you have symptoms and perfect health. And that's what leads a lot of people to have health issues that can be related to root canals, amalgams, and cavitations.
And many times if you have a tooth pulled, you end up wearing a bridge, and a lot of people, they just don't want to do that for cosmetic reasons.
Oh, there are lots of reasons why. I mean, who would want to have a tooth pulled? You'd like to have your teeth. I mean, some people have had 6 or 8 or 10 root canals, and they're still okay. But you wonder, well, they've lost their wellness buffer to an extent, and you'd like to have perfect health, but it costs a lot of money. You're not going to advise people a lot of the time to go spend $15,000 or $20,000 to have all the mercury taken out of their mouth, or maybe get a few cavitations and root canals fixed because they can't afford it.
Well, and it's a big process. It's not just having the amalgams taken out. You need to do things. There are supplements and things that you take because you don't want to have them all taken out at once because it can go to your brain. The mercury can go to your brain.
A big issue. It's time the American Dental Association, the American Medical Association, realize that there's more to dentistry than just putting in a filling that's going to last a long time. And this obstinance that both professions have that really is nonsense. I mean, to think that you would be able to put something that's as toxic as mercury, either in a toxic waste dump or your mouth. I mean, that's a crazy choice to have to make. So we need to wake up and start doing things that make a little bit more sense to take care of our health. And we've got to get our dentists and our doctors on the right track or it's simply not going to happen. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health on PRN.FM. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. It's time for Nurse Vicki's first 2020 tip on holding awake and a dead ringer. Boy, that doesn't make much sense, but it will in a minute. And when we come back, we'll be talking about why iron is important in infections, cancer, aging, and brain development. Stay tuned.
Well, speaking of heavy metals, people used to drink ale or whiskey out of lead cups, and the combination would sometimes knock the imbibers out for a couple of days. Well, someone walking along the road would take them for dead and prepare them for burial. Then they were laid out on the kitchen table for a couple of days, and the family would gather around and eat and drink and wait and see if they would wake up.
Jeez.
Hence the custom, holding awake.
Oh, my gosh.
Don't you wonder sometimes how things get started, you know, sayings? And
we take those things so much for granted, but it's really kind of fun to see how they're derived and what the meaning is actually all about.
Well, I have another one. In the olden days, because England was a small place, the local folks started running out of places to bury people. So they'd dig up coffins and they'd take the bones to a bone house and reuse the grave. Don't want to waste anything, you know.
Right.
Well, when reopening these coffins, one out of 25 coffins were found to have scratch marks on the inside.
Oh, no.
And they realized that they'd been burying people alive. So they'd tie a string on the wrist of the corpse and lead it through the coffin and up through the ground and tie it to a bell. And then somebody would have to sit out in the graveyard all night, the graveyard shift, to listen for the bell.
Oh,
thus,
God.
Somebody could be saved by the bell or was considered a dead ringer.
Oh, God.
You know, it's healthy to laugh at ourselves.
Yeah, it's good.
Rather than the alternative.
It's good medicine, too.
Yeah, okay, so more on heavy metals. I want to talk about, we're going to talk about iron now, because iron can be a good thing or a bad thing, and we don't want too much or not enough.
Right.
So too much can increase the risk of bacterial infection, and if an infant has an iron deficiency, it can affect learning and memory, and it can have actually irreversible delays in cognition, and it can increase the risk for mental retardation. So, who should have iron levels tested and how often?
That's a good point. It's not generally been thought to be a routine test, but it should be. And I check it on all of my patients because about, I'd say, 5 to 10% of the population has some kind of abnormality in iron metabolism. And usually that's a form of what's called hemochromatosis. Hemochromatosis means that you have the genes that cause you to retain iron in amounts that are high.
And that's really serious. I know people that have hemochromatosis often have to go and have bloodletting.
Well, they've got to get rid of the
extra
iron. Instead of giving
them a transfusion, they take it out of them.
So what happens is that extra iron that's in there causes a reaction in the body with peroxide that leads to the formation of hydroxyl radical, which is a complicated way of saying is it makes you age too fast.
Well, it also can lead to bacterial infections and cancer.
It is something that bacteria require a lot of the time to be able to take hold and cause an infection to occur. And the example of E. coli, for example, was studied, and what they found is that if you could deprive E. coli of enough iron in the body, that it became 10,000-fold less able to grow and host tissues. So you're looking at something that's really important here, and it's why there's such a competition between the host and the microbes for iron.
Well, this is like what we were just talking about, you know, with the heavy metals in your body, like the mercury and the copper,
mm-hmm.
and how those are a magnet for bacteria. And so now it's iron that also increases the risk of bacterial infection.
Well, it all gets complicated because copper is something, for example, we just said a little bit of copper is bad for your amalgams because it leaches out the copper and it leaches out the mercury 50 times faster. But it's also something that if you used in hospital rooms and put it on surfaces where people touch a lot, that it kills the microbes in about 90 seconds.
So it's interesting it does just the opposite when it's inside the body.
Well, it's a balance. And even when it's inside the body, too much or too little is no good. It's got to be just right. And the problem is we don't basically understand cell biochemistry. We know pieces of it, but we don't know the details of it. And when you look at the big picture, we're basically fairly ignorant.
So with copper in our bodies, we need just a little tiny bit.
Mm-hmm.
And in our teeth, we don't want any at all.
Well, not in our amalgams. If you have the copper amalgams, that causes a problem with the leaching out of both copper and mercury. That's what we were talking about in the last segment.
So tell us about the role of iron with artemisinin for cancer therapy.
Well, first of all, cancer cells sequester iron. And if they do, then they become a target for anything that can cause iron to make free radicals at a faster pace. Because free radicals, if you make them too fast, will kill the cell. So iron is sequestered by most cancer cells, sometimes by a thousandfold, like in some leukemias, but maybe other times it's just 30 or 40 times as much. But if you give them wormwood extract, which has got artemisinin in it, what happens is it causes a reaction that produces a lot of free radicals, and it kills the cells that have the most iron in them. So it preferentially will kill cancer cells and spare those that are normal.
So it converts the iron into a free radical that kills itself.
Exactly. It kills its own
cell. So if somebody has cancer, then they don't want to have much iron in their diet. They certainly don't want to take a vitamin pill that has any iron in it.
Well,
and would you recommend that people that have cancer eat a low meat diet or maybe a vegetarian diet?
Well, it depends. See, now you asked me the question of the beginning, who should have their cancer or who should have their iron levels measured and how often? And the answer is it depends on the situation, but everybody should have a baseline test.
Mm-hmm.
If you have cancer, a lot of people have anemia. They have a low blood count. And the tendency of a lot of doctors is to empirically just give iron without measuring iron levels and see if they can make the blood count raise. But a lot of the times you can't, and then you just start storing too much iron, and it makes the cancer grow fast.
What's Procrit? I hear them advertise that on TV all the time for people that have cancer.
Those are drugs that raise the level of the blood count, okay? And they also cause blood to get thick. And they cause heart attacks and strokes.
So it, too, is
balanced.
But that doesn't increase your iron level, though.
No, it doesn't have anything to do with iron. It has to do with stimulating some of the hormones in the kidney to be able to make more blood cells, which is what you need in that setting.
I see.
So everything here we're talking about is a matter of balance. You need a little, not too much. It's like baby bear's porridge. It's got to be just right.
That's right. Well, on the other hand, children need iron for brain development.
There you go.
So I know that there's some iron in milk, lactoferrin. Is that enough?
Well, lactoferrin is a protein, okay, that binds iron. So it will competitively bind iron. And if you have a lot of lactoferrin in your system, as we do in our bodies, we have a lot of it in our intestinal tracts. When we have bacteria that come in there, there's a competition for the bacteria to bind the iron and a competition for the lactoferrin as a body's mechanism to bind the iron. And the one that wins does the best in terms of who's going to survive.
This is why it's so important for pregnant women to supplement with iron.
A little bit of iron. But if they have the recessive gene or the dominant gene for hemochromatosis, they don't want to be doing that because they're going to be caught. A lot of free radical damage is going to be going on and be bad for the baby.
So
you can't, as a rule, do anything. You've got to measure and find out where you are.
Now, menstruating women need iron, too.
As a general rule, that's right. But those that have the recessive gene for hemochromatosis, you would have to measure to see where you are. Because you can sequester 1,000 times the amount of iron that your body needs, and then you know you're really in trouble.
As long as everything is pretty normal and you don't have a disease like hemochromatosis or something.
Yeah, but keep in mind, 5 or 10% of the population does.
And
we overlook
it, huh?
Well, nobody's checking for it as a routine. It's getting to be something we know more about. And so,
what's the test for that?
Well, it's just a blood test that looks for ferritin levels, which is a protein that carries iron inside the body.
Well, that's good. So people should know to ask their doctors to do a ferritin level then.
Well, that would be one. You should really measure four tests: a serum iron binding capacity, a ferritin, and a percent saturation of serum transferrin. So you can see it's complicated. And I normally wouldn't talk about stuff that's that complex, but you need to know it's not just simple. All these things are balanced by very complicated biofeedback mechanisms that we need to know about.
Also, men and postmenopausal women don't need much, and they should be careful not to get too much and not to cook with an iron skillet or take vitamin supplements with iron.
Well, those are all good points, and they're things that we need to know. But it's going back to the first question you asked, Vicki: who should have their iron measured and how often? Everybody should have it measured at some time, and how often depends on whether or not you have a problem with either too little or too much iron. It's time for a PRN.FM station break. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuti here with Nurse Vicki. We'll be right back with more Prescriptions for Health Radio on the Progressive Radio Network, and we'll be talking about, is it DNA or lifestyle that regulates our genes? So stay tuned for more Prescriptions for Health Radio. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. Welcome back. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki.
If your parents had cancer, are you doomed to have cancer too? If you live a healthy lifestyle and you change your body's environment, can you change your DNA, your genes? What's the difference between epigenetics and genetics?
Very good question. And until the last few years, epigenetics was something we didn't really talk about much. Genetics is all about genes and DNA. And that's supposed to be the holy grail for what determines what diseases you'll have, what color eyes you'll have, how tall you'll be, all these factors that we associated with DNA and genes. Epigenetics is different. These are the things in the environment that change how the DNA expresses itself in genes. So basically what it's saying is that DNA is not fixed. Your genes are not fixed. There are many aspects of the biochemistry of genes that can be affected by the environment that you live in. For example, just because you have the BRCA gene defect, which means most people will get breast cancer who have it, doesn't mean that you'll get it, because it depends on whether or not you trigger that gene to turn into an active cancer-producing gene or not. And that's usually determined by environmental toxins of one sort or another.
This reminds me of Pasteur and Beauchamp talking about germs and talking about whether it's the environment and whether your immune system is strong, if you can resist it.
Right.
Or if it's just the germ and you're going to get it anyway.
Right. Well, it's very similar. And, of course, both are important. The germs are important. I mean, if there weren't any germs, we probably wouldn't get infected by germs, right? If they weren't there. But if we have good immune resistance, if there are germs there, some people will get it and some people won't, depending on whether or not immunity is strong.
Okay, so let's start out talking about methylation and what that is and how that's related to the risk of getting cancer.
Okay, well, basically, one of the things that makes us age and one of the things that causes genetic abnormalities that cause colon cancer is whether or not a methyl group, which is a carbon and three hydrogens, it's a CH3 group, will be attaching to different parts of the DNA, different parts of the genes. And if it does, it can cause them to malfunction and put you at risk for cancer. So what we're finding is that there are some things that cause cancer, and there are by changing the biochemistry of DNA, and some things that protect against it.
So some of these risk factors that were found by the British study showed that selenium and vitamin D can protect against this methylation, thus protect us against cancer.
Exactly.
And that too much folate and being obese can actually increase the risk of colon cancer. Now, these factors turn the genes on and off.
Exactly.
And they said especially for people over 50.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering if this could be the reason that colonoscopies are recommended for people over 50.
It would be one of the reasons, because there's an abrupt rise in the incidence of cancer as we get over age 50, particularly in men, because men tend to have more colon cancer than women do. So, yes, that's something that we need to know about. So actually, those factors should be paid a great deal of attention to, because they're more powerful than any other medicines or any other drugs that we have to help prevent cancer or to help cancer from keep it from coming back.
But you don't want too much selenium. I mean, what would be the doses of selenium?
Maybe 100 micrograms a day, something like that. And vitamin D, you want to keep your levels probably 50 to 60.
So a good vitamin pill would probably have the selenium in it, or could you just get that from your diet?
Well, you can get it from your diet. I mean, you'd find it in things like Brazil nuts. It's a real interesting place where you get selenium. And vitamin D, of course, isn't coming so much from your diet. It's coming from sunlight. And most people, particularly in the wintertime, and especially in the northern or far southern latitudes, don't get much vitamin D at all. So what we need to do is supplement for it. And the average person probably needs in the range of 2,000 to 5,000 or 6,000 IUs per day of vitamin D3.
Okay, now, a woman that's pregnant, it's recommended that she take folate because of the baby.
They get neural tube defects. It can lead to cleft palates and other kinds of problems like that. They can be very disfiguring.
What would be a dosage that would be recommended for taking folate then?
A few hundred micrograms a day is probably sufficient, and that's what you find in most prenatal pills. What this is showing is is that it's very important to know the ranges and the situations that you're talking about. Because when there is too much of anything, it's a problem. And if there's too little of anything, there's a problem. Our biochemistry is so complicated that no one on the planet has a clue.
This is
about 95%.
Better just to eat the right diet.
Well, if you stick close to nature, she's done it for you.
If you can, that's the trouble. There's so many processed foods and everything.
You have to be educated, or else you need to live in a place other than a city. You know, if you grow up in a forest or in the woods, you're going to eat what you can get. It's all going to be natural, and it's probably going to be just right for you. But with transportation being what it is, it's mixed up all these things. I mean, you wouldn't want to feed an Eskimo a lot of carbohydrate, and you wouldn't want to feed normal people a whole lot of fat. We have different ways, depending on who we are, where we were born, what our ethnic backgrounds are, that determine what the best diet is for us, and that's usually by location.
Okay, so besides a healthy diet and a healthy weight, how do other lifestyles like stress reduction and getting enough sleep and exercising and reducing toxic exposures compare to chemotherapy and cancer?
So if you're talking about how to make cancer stay away after you've got it, lifestyle is still your most potent medicine. The chemotherapies that we have, particularly for stage 4 cancers, have a 5-year survival rate of less than 3%. I mean, that's a terrifying number. And things like having enough vitamin D, exercise, getting enough sleep, reducing stress, avoiding environmental toxins, not smoking, not consuming a lot of alcohol. These are real powerful things, but we don't get trained that way as physicians to think, because we're more into the silver bullet mentality. And of course, that costs more and it doesn't work as well.
Well, Dean Ornish's prostate cancer study is an example of that, of how lifestyle reduced the risk of cancer.
That's a beautiful study. I have to take my hat off to Dean Ornish for that study. He basically looked at a few hundred people who had watch and wait prostate cancers, meaning they were early stage cancers, and it was reasonable to follow them until something changed the state that the cancer was in. And in those people, and he biopsied all of them and then measured 500 oncogenes, which are cancer genes, to see if they're turned on or off. And in the total number of patients that were in that study, all of them had their oncogenes turned on, and they had cancer. At the end of 3 months, half of those patients they did nothing to, and they re-biopsied them. Nothing changed. You wouldn't expect it to. The oncogenes were still turned on. Cancer was progressing. And the people who had lifestyle changes like what we're talking about, plus yoga and meditation and diet and exercise and all this stuff, those oncogenes were turned off at 3 months when they re-biopsied them. So what we're looking at is the epigenetics of what's going on and the genetics of what's going on, because they both matter.
So there's hope for epigenetic changes in our DNA if our parents had cancer, and we can change our destiny.
Right. We're not stuck with what we're born with necessarily, although there are some genetic diseases that are genetic that we haven't learned enough about yet. We don't know what the triggers are.
And but there's hope.
Well, there's hope for some of them. For others who have certain kinds of, say, muscular dystrophy, your goose is still cooked pretty much, because we don't know how to turn those genes off.
Mm-hmm.
And there may be absence of genes. So when we're looking at the kinds of things that we do in medicine that are really terrific, looking at stem cell therapy and genetic changes in our DNA, this is big news. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health on PRN.FM. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki, and it's time for Nurse Vicki's final 2020 tip on
stevia and the medicinal uses of it.
And when we come back, we'll be talking about, can rice bran protect against cancer? And are there essential oils that are a good way to lower blood pressure? So stay tuned.
Sugar's not healthy, and artificial sweeteners aren't healthy, but there have been 1,500 published studies on stevia, and stevia has been shown to be safe in the leaf form or if it's properly extracted from glycosides. Now, stevia is a native plant that was that grows in Paraguay, and it's been around for a long time. In fact, it's been used by the natives for 1,500 to 2,000 years, and it's far more than just a sweetener. They started out using it as a sweetener in the mate tea, And it's sweet.
It needs it, too.
Yeah. And it's sweet, but it has a slight licorice flavor. It's three times sweeter than sugar, so it must be blended with a carrier. And it's often used as a breath freshener. But the medicinal qualities that were given by the medicine men for so many years ago were given to them for fatigue and diabetes, dizziness, and a tonic for an upset stomach. It was also used to lower blood pressure. It's been given for energy and mental alertness, to decrease cavities, and also to get rid of that oral bacteria that's causing those cavities. Topically, it heals cuts and sores, and it's good for sores on your lip or inside your mouth. It's good for skin problems. It even decreases wrinkles. And there are no known allergies to it, and it actually increases your quality of life. And studies show that stevia is even an antibacterial, anti-carcinogenic, anti-edema, anti-stress, antifungal, anti-hyperglycemic, and it's a hypotensive, and it increases cognitive function and concentration, and it helps people to sleep better.
Jeez, bring on the stevia.
It helps smokers to quit.
Really?
They put a leaf in their mouth instead of a cigarette or chewing tobacco. It contains ascorbic acid, beta-carotene, flavonoid, thiamine, calcium, chromium, iron, magnesium, manganese, niacin, phosphorus, potassium, selenium, silicone, and so on and so forth. It contains vegetables, and it's a vegetable, and because it's a plant, and it contains fat and fiber and protein and these sweet glycosides. And leaves also contain flavonoid polyphenols like quercetin and rutin and more. So it can easily be extracted, the nutrients, in water, especially if it's hot water like a tea. And many manufacturers in extracting the glycosides from the sugar use chemicals, solvents, and alcohol. But even if they do, it's still better than artificial sweeteners. And the best is extracted with water in a nanofilter system. The extraction process can alter the flavor, and some have an unpleasant aftertaste. So you need to read the ingredients, because they often add another sweetener to the stevia. And a third of a teaspoon equals 1 cup of sugar as far as the sweetness goes.
Wow.
So when a cup of coffee, all you need is the touch of a toothpick. That's just a teeny little bit. There's no calories. There's no glycemic index. And if we use stevia, we can decrease our sugar and artificial sweeteners and improve our health and well-being.
Well, look what Mother Nature can do in just one little leaf. Isn't that amazing? Try it and do something like that out of a test tube. It just hardly ever happens. In fact, I don't know of a single time when something we've made has been as miraculous as something like stevia.
Well, I'm going to go get some stevia.
Okay.
You know, we're always looking for healthy ways to lower our risk of cancer. And so now we have a new clinical trial that's showing that rice bran may prevent cancer. So isn't this good news? With rice being a staple all over the world with 100,000 varieties of rice. But it's important to get the bran, and that's in the brown rice, and it's taken out with the conversion to white rice.
Right. Well, these substances like this are very interesting. And again, it's out of Mother Nature. And the whole product, the whole leaf or the whole vegetable or the whole whatever it is that you're consuming is way better than taking out just parts of it. But in this case, things like inositol hexaniacinate, which is a...
That's a mouthful.
Well, it's called IP6 for that reason. It's something that is used. It has a lot of fiber in it. It's mostly the fiber. It's in cereal grains and beans and brown rice, like you said, and corn and sesame and wheat bran. There are lots of places where you find this rice bran-like substance that helps to prevent cancer and also prevent the recurrence of cancer. In fact,
some people use rice bran oil, too.
Yes. And this is a study, okay, that's being done presently at the University of California Cancer Center, or University of Colorado Cancer Center, and that was published in the journal Advances in Nutrition. It shows that rice bran really offers a promising cancer prevention strategy.
So this is like, instead of chemotherapy, chemo prevention.
Well, and it's also used as chemotherapy because it can prevent the recurrence of cancer, which is a lot of what chemotherapy is about as well.
Except for chemotherapy hurts the good cells.
Well, indeed. That's right. And this doesn't have... There you go with Mother Nature again. See, she's got everything worked out. All you have to do is listen and be smart about what you consume. Don't do things to excesses or avoid them. Have a balanced diet and have a good lifestyle. And all these diseases we're seeing, would be a tremendous health care reform project for the government to take a look at.
Well, we need to be working harder on preventing cancer than how to cure it, really.
Well, for sure. And when you look at something like this rice brand they're talking about, look at all the things it does. It inhibits cell proliferation, which is a good thing. You don't want cells growing too fast. It alters the way cells divide so that it's not cancerous the way it does. And it initiates cells to die when they're supposed to, something called apoptosis. So that's what's called programmed cell death. And that's what is wrong with people who have cancer. It's those cancer cells don't know how to die. They just keep on growing and multiplying, and they crowd out a lot of the organ systems that are in our body.
Well, it also creates conditions in the surrounding tissues to promote the function of healthy cells while it's inhibiting the cancer cell function. So that's something that chemotherapy doesn't do.
That's right. And it also does something to reduce chronic inflammation. So it's really nice to have something that promotes anti-cancer immune responses. It regulates the microflora of the gut to help it protect against cancer, too, because the fiber that's there encourages the right kinds of bacteria to grow, the ones that are healthy for your intestinal tract and the ones that protect against forming carcinogens, or it helps to reduce the carcinogens that are there by metabolizing them.
Well, isn't all this great? Because rice is plentiful around the world, and this has the potential to impact much of the world.
Well, I think we're on to something here that makes some sense, and it just reminds me that lifestyle is your best medicine. There is nothing that comes close to it. And to have something, a study like this that comes out that looks at the many different ways that you can use fiber, okay, to improve your health is just remarkable.
And your hair doesn't fall out, and it has fiber and protein and vitamins and minerals and essential fatty acids, along with the starch.
Yeah, it can even taste good. And if you want to take a medicine, take IP6. It's a lot of the same thing.
So our other topic is hypertension or high blood pressure, and it's not to be taken lightly because it's a risk factor for strokes and heart attacks and heart failure and arterial aneurysms like an aortic aneurysm, peripheral artery disease, and it can even cause chronic kidney disease. And high blood pressure can shorten life expectancy. Now, most people with high blood pressure don't like the side effects of the drugs that can make them tired and many times to urinate frequently. But the good news is that there are lifestyle measures like diet and exercise and some natural alternative methods that can reduce blood pressure. So when we say hypertension, it reveals tension. So, of course, stress reduction is helpful. So let's talk about this study that showed how to reduce stress and, in turn, reduce blood pressure.
Yeah, it's interesting because we know the things that quieten us down lower blood pressure. It's interesting that when people go into the hospital, which is kind of a high-stress place, they're in bed most of the time. And people who have hypertension that lay in bed are sedated most of the time. Their blood pressure drops like a rock. And almost everybody who has hypertension that goes in the hospital, it's there for a few days, they don't need their medicines anymore. It's when you come out that you go back to the usual stresses of life where you're worrying, you're not in the moment, you're not in that what I call the zone of life, which is being in the moment. This is what happens. So an interesting study was done in the European Journal of Preventive Cardiology and showed that aromatherapy is a pretty good thing for stress relief. And what they did is they looked at exposing people to a certain kind of essential oil for an hour.
Bergamot.
Okay. And when people were exposed to that, it dropped their heart rate and their blood pressure as long as it was short-term exposure. And the benefits were reversed when the exposure lasted more than an hour. It's kind of interesting that a little bit is good and too much is bad.
It really is interesting.
It's the same old theme we've been on today, that baby bear's porridge, you know, is just right. And all the rest of them cause problems.
Well, it's interesting because, like, when you go into a spa, many times you can smell the essential oils.
Yeah.
Or the aromatherapy, mm-hmm. Because they want it to smell like that. Mm-hmm. And you associate that with being relaxed and so forth. But what about the people that are working there? If they're inhaling this
all
day long,
that
they might be getting what you're not getting. Mm-hmm. So it's like, well, you're reducing your risk of cardiovascular disease and they're increasing their risk of cardiovascular disease.
There are a lot of things that relax us in some ways, but too much
massage is relaxing in itself.
Well, I was thinking this time of when you go to church, Vicki. you're exposed to candles that are burning, and you're exposed to incense. And when you're exposed to that for a long for a period of time that's long enough, it actually increases lung disease. It makes emphysema worse, and it may predispose to asthma, and it may raise your blood pressure.
But usually when you're in church, most of the time you're only there for an hour.
No, I understand. I was just using it as an example.
But frankincense is one of the oils that helps to reduce blood pressure.
Sure.
And that's one that's frequently used in church. Other oils that are antihypertensive are things like lavender and chamomile and yang-yang and rose, neroli oil, sweet marjoram, clary sage, geranium, and spruce.
Yeah, these are... We should be using these more often. I think using a low dose of this sort of thing, like in the waiting room, or in a office where a psychiatrist or a psychologist is doing
maybe
work.
Maybe you could start doing that in your office, too.
I've thought about that many times, and I talked to somebody who's a really world-class herbalist, and she told me which ones to use, but I've forgotten now. You told me some of the other ones. That's right.
Yeah. But, you know, if you use beeswax-scented candles, you don't want to use the regular candles because those are petroleum.
Right.
And those are not healthy to inhale.
Right.
But if you use beeswax-scented candles or use an infuser or an ultrasonic ionizer.
Right.
Those are good ways to treat yourself with aromatherapy.
One of the things I found interesting is that there's many, many hundreds of volatile oils. They're called volatile organic chemicals that when you heat these oils, they evaporate. And that's what volatile means, that it's hot. And when it does, it evaporates quicker than not, just like boiling water will evaporate much quicker than water that's cold. But over time, even cold water will evaporate. And there are hundreds and hundreds of different kinds of chemicals that are in there. So when you stick with the natural things and don't do them to excesses, you're probably going to be doing something where you overall get a benefit that you want.
This is what we've been talking about this whole show, is to do everything just right. You know, do it in moderation, not
exactly.
Too much, not enough.
And that goes for a lot of things. I mean, one of the questions we're asking here when we're talking about treating blood pressure is, how do you get people to relax? Lots of ways. Exercise is a beauty. Meditation, hypnotherapy, heart math.
Qigong,
another one. Laughter.
Acupuncture.
Right.
Massage.
Right. I think what these things do is they get you in the moment, in the present tense, which I call the zone of life. That's a place where you're not thinking of anything, but you're deeply in a receiving state where you're noticing what's unfolding in your life. And that takes you into a place where you can't do anything else, because fortunately we can only be in one place at a time. And when we focus in that one place, we can't worry about something else. We're just in that one place. And all these things we're talking about, and you can add to that things like music and art and rituals and playing, you know, playing an instrument of some kind, or just playing like improvisational games is that way, or even in a sweat lodge. All these things are that way.
Maybe even a rocking chair. And, of course, being with people you enjoy being around.
Exactly. All right, we're at the close of the show here. I'd like to remind you that we'll be back to talk live about what's new in the news and health every Monday morning on PRN.FM and drsabuta.com from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. Prescriptions for Health will also be available 24/7 on drsaputo.com as well as prn.fm.
And if you enjoyed today's show and you'd like to have more information on the topics we discussed, go to Dr. Saputo Radio on drsaputo.com and check out our Fast Track videos. And remember, lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe. So if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.
Have a great week, and we'll see you next time.